Welcome to the Nep Wildland podcast with me, Penny Green, Nep's ecologist. It's a beautiful April day in 2022 and I'm out with a gang of people from the Natural History Museum as we are looking to sample some of the earthworms that we have here and learn a bit more about them.
I think we've got a lot.
I'm just approaching a mischievous looking pair. Hi guys, I'm very excited to have you here today. I've got Emma Sherlock and Kieran Brown from the Natural History Museum to talk to us about earthworms. We are here doing some sampling and I'd love to learn a bit more about that. But first of all, what do you call an earthworm specialist? It's not a joke. It sounds like it's out of a cracker, but it's not.
What's
your job title?
Well, I'm the curator of annelids at the Natural History Museum. So that does also include the earthworms, cousins of the marine bristleworms and leeches as well. But earthworms are my favourite.
A right answer.
Yes, of course.
I run a project for the Field Studies Council, so I actually work for them, and that's teaching people to identify earthworms and other invertebrates that are under-recorded yet very, very important ecologically.
Of course.
But so to answer your question, Penny, there isn't a term for it. I actually did a little vote on Facebook for this, and I can't remember what won, but one of the options was wormologist.
Analidiologist. Yeah. What about that?
And I think we just settled on earthworm scientist or something like that. Yeah. But I think you're an earthworm worm taxonomist, Emma.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to be. but I guess you could go old school and go vermologist, I suppose, and back to the old vermes.
Vermes.
And maybe
that's cool.
Rolls off the tongue a little bit better.
First place, earthworm scientist makes it a bit more accessible to people that don't know about these things. So
that is true. It all sounds good with me.
It does. And so, yeah, both of you, how on earth, literally, how on earth have you come to love worms so much?
Well, one thing is they are fantastic creatures to love, but it is true that you have to get to know them, I guess, first before you realise how amazing they are, which is why with the Earthworm Society we're trying to get that message across to everyone. But for me, it was just the fact that I always wanted to work in natural history, and I started volunteering at the Natural History Museum when I finished my zoology degree, and then I was able to get a job as a curator in the invertebrate group. And one of my first scientific visitors was this amazing earthworm scientist from Romania called Victor Pop, and he was just so inspirational, and he took me to Transylvania, and
we went up
in the Carpathian Mountains and saw like the largest earthworms in Europe. And
how big are the largest earthworms in Europe?
They're over a metre long.
Biggest in the world.
No,
what are the biggest in the world, Kieran?
Well, Emma has a specimen of the biggest, the biggest species in the world. How big is it? How big is your specimen?
Well, it's about 2 meters. Obviously, with earthworms, because they expand and contract, it's actually really hard to measure them. And there are some people in South Africa that reckon their earthworms are actually bigger, but officially,
it's not a competition. Well,
if it is in Britain, we wouldn't win. That we'd reach 40 centimeters. That's still massive for an invertebrate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think about imagine if we had beetles and butterflies that were 40 centimeters
big.
That's for invertebrates, earthworms are pretty much as big as you get in the UK.
Yes, and also, when you really start to study them as well, and they're everywhere, really accessible, they're actually really diverse as well in their coloration and sizes and how muscular they are, and people will be surprised.
They're so fascinating, aren't they? And I believe is it 4 different kind of groups to earthworms?
Ecotypes,
yes. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Right, so earthworms are called ecosystem engineers because they do so much to our natural environment. But actually, different groupings of the species actually take on different roles. So you'll have some earthworms, what we call the anisic earthworms, which actually have vertical burrows in the soil, and they dig really deep but come up to the surface, and they are hugely important for drainage of the soil, aeration of the soil. They also bring organic matter deep into the soil. But they, again, have a different role from, let's say, our little red kind of epigeic worms, which live on the surface. They consume, or just underneath, they consume kind of dead wood and things like that, and dead organic matter on the surface. And they, again, are different from what we call our endogeic worms, which are this kind of grey, kind of greeny coloured worms, the sort of middle sized worms. The anisics are the big ones, epigeic's usually smaller, and the endogeics are more the kind of middle sized, yeah, grey, pinky, sometimes tinges of sort of bluey purples. And they're, yeah, in the soil, they have horizontal burrows, and they're actually consuming a lot of the soil itself. And then they have this amazing, well, all earthworms have amazing symbiotic relationships with the gut bacteria and things, but they are real powerhouses for converting the soil into forms that the plants can take up more readily. They use their cropping gizzard, that they're a bit like a bird, they grind it all up, yeah, they convert the nutrients, and they're a real, yeah, powerhouses under your feet at getting all that amazing organic rich material back into the soil.
So they really are like proper ecosystem engineers. They're creating an amazing habitat for other wildlife, yes, to be able to live there, and helping to restore landscapes. So like on a rewilding kind of scale, you know, getting earthworms back in the soil after intensive farming, say for example here at NEP, is one of the most important things that could be happening here.
Oh, absolutely. There are studies of I don't have the figures to hand, but I can find it, of like how many tons of like dead leaves, even just Lumbricus terrestris, one species, will actually move on a set area in a year. It's just staggering. And I think it was the Irish government tried to do a survey of earthworms in general, like how much money it would cost to do the jobs earthworms were doing, and it was, you know, millions and millions of pounds a year. They really are, yeah.
Amazing. We should be all learning to love the earthworm a bit more, shouldn't we?
Oh, of course, absolutely.
And I love your enthusiasm. So hopefully that's getting a lot more people to love earthworms. It's great.
I hope so.
Well, the great thing about studying earthworms is there's so little still that we don't know. A lot of the information we ask, so we get asked a lot, how long does an earthworm live? How many young do they have? And even basic information like that, we don't have at a species level. We have some general things we can say about the odd species that's been studied here and there. And that is why I love studying them, because we are literally still putting dots on the map. There are areas the size of Wales that have very few earthworm records. And the UK is actually well ahead of a lot of the rest of the world. So if you go out to the Middle East or Africa and you look for earthworms, chances are what you're going to find are going to be species that are new to science. So studying earthworms is still very much a frontier science, and even going out and recording the species that you've got in a garden is giving us probably new species for that area. As an example, I was taking people out to some sites in Herefordshire just a couple of weeks back, and we had over 10 new species for the county. And I mean, if we were studying birds, we wouldn't stand a chance.
Exactly, it's just remarkable, isn't it, really? So like, if people like at home are listening to this, how many earthworms could you expect to find in an average garden?
A really interesting question. So first time I ever looked at earthworms outside of the volunteering that I did at the Natural History Museum, I dug up my parents' garden, much to their dismay.
The whole of the garden.
Well, no, just 25 centimetre by 25 centimetre to a depth of about 20 centimetre soil pits in the garden, with my mum looking in horror from the kitchen window what I was doing to her garden. And I took those earthworms and I identified them, and I had four species. I then did it a second time 6 months later, and I got another four species, but one was a repeat, so it went up to seven. And then I looked under some plant pots that were on a paved area that was a bit wet, and I think I'm now sitting at over 15 species in that one garden. It's been sampled maybe five or six times, and we only have 29 species in Great Britain. So over half of the British fauna can be found in a garden. Because gardens are such a mosaic of habitats, and there's so many different places in a garden that you can find them. For example, like a compost bin.
I bet that's amazing. It's like heaven for an earthworm, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there are certain species that you will only find in compost bins, or naturally you'd find them in dung piles, really high organic content micro habitats. But Yeah, gardens are actually great for earthworms because we've got lawns, we've got leaf litter, we've got the roots of plants, we've got lots of different little microhabitats for them. So yeah, a garden's quite often better than a really pristine nature reserve, to be honest, for species diversity.
Oh, that's good to know, because people at home can think, oh, you know, I'm doing something good. You know, if you're sort of got a nice wildlife garden that you've let go a bit wild and it's not manicured and it's not having sort of fertilisers and herbicides put on the grass, you know, that must be pretty good for worms.
Well, that's the main thing. If you've got a garden, I know people like their gardens to be pristine, but please leave some messy.
Yeah, definitely.
We love a messy garden, especially if you can leave some dead wood around, have the leaves sit on the surface a little bit, don't rake them up. If you do mow the lawn, leave some mowings down, have a compost, maybe have a pond as well, because adding that extra water into the garden too is always good. You'll get maybe slightly different species there as well. And again, having things like the plant pots, all these refuges as well for earthworms, all of that is great.
They're all finding their niches, aren't they? So yes. Worms kind
the way I look at it is the job that earthworms do is they convert waste in your garden into something useful. They break down the soil further so that it can be utilized by plants, and so that it's more habitable for other other animals, bacteria, etc. They aerate and drain the soil. They break down waste plant and animal materials. So anything you're taking out of the garden, you're taking away from the earthworms. So you don't need to use fertilizers if you've got earthworms doing the job that they need to do, because they're acting as nature's plow, and they're restoring all the nutrients to the soil, making them available. And in addition to that, forgot what I was going to say.
There's lots of additions.
In addition to that, any pesticides that you're putting into your garden, whether you're putting fertilizers, whether you're putting herbicides, insecticides, all of these things can easily be taken up by earthworms. And even if they don't harm or kill the earthworms, they can accumulate, bioaccumulate in the earthworms. And one thing that earthworms provide for our wildlife is a source of food. Everything eats earthworms. Garden birds, frogs, toads, newts, reptiles, badgers love a lobworm, that Lumbricus terrestris.
Slurping them up like spaghetti.
Exactly. foxes, even birds of prey, and lots of other invertebrates. Their cousins, the leeches, don't mind munching on an earthworm. So they do suck them up like spaghetti.
Yes, they do.
Quite
their
horrific.
Own cousins as well. That's terrible.
Yeah. No problem to them.
Not using pesticides and other chemicals in your garden means that the earthworms are going to be a safe meal for all the other wildlife that's there as well.
And you guys are here for a very specific thing today, which is very exciting. So I don't want to stop you doing what you were doing, so do carry on sampling. So why are you here today?
Well, we've come also with the Darwin Tree of Life team from the Natural History Museum, and so the Darwin Tree of Life project is trying to properly genetically sequence as much of the British wildlife as we possibly can. So this is whole genome sequencing, which is really, really exciting. So as well as obviously adding to the NEP a list of earthworms that we're hoping to be able to add to the inventory of what's here, so doing really good work for that. We're also taking bits of tissue as well to then be sent off for this really really big project, trying to fully sequence the earthworms. So in terms of the mechanics of that, I'm not the expert on that, so you might want to chat.
I'm going to go speak to them in a moment,
Chris and Ines, because they know a lot more about the ins and outs of that than me. But it's really, really brilliant. And already for earthworms, we've found a really good differentiation between two of our difficult composting species. We hadn't formally recorded Andreae being in the UK before, because although it's been proven genetically in other papers, it's very hard to, you know, it's inaccessible really for most recorders to be able to actually get barcoding done, and this is taking it to another level, but already we've actually shown that we definitively do have that in the UK, and then we're going to be able to see how similar everything is and yeah, really answer a few of these genetic questions. There's always arguments how different people have barcoded in a different way and cryptic species and all of that. We're hoping, yeah, we might get a few more answers after this.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Emma. So for the sampling here today, what kind of methods are we using to find worms?
Right, so we're doing the usual soil pit digging. So we've been going through the soil and finding worms that way, but also lots of microhabitat searching, which is where we get some of our most exciting species in a way, or some of our rarer anyway. So we're looking under dead wood, in dead wood, yeah, turning things over.
That's great. We've just come down to a nice little bit of wet woodland next to the mill pond here, and there's like a nice open rushy area as well, which I think we're going to go and have a little look around as well. So were you just about to search under some of the dead wood around here? Should we see what we can find?
Turn over some of these bits, see if there's anything, and just move away some of the leaves as well. See if there's anything surface.
They often pull the leaves down into the ground, don't they?
Yes, so those are the anisic earthworms. And Lumbricus in particular, you can sometimes find it in woodlands if you look around, because they make these little middens. So what you do is you see maybe like a place where there's a few strategically placed leaves, and if you move them away, you'd see their hole. And basically, yeah, I think there's a number of reasons people say they do that, but probably it's a bit of kind of protection.
Umbrella.
Over, yeah. Yes. So it doesn't get completely flooded out. If water falls, that will be dispersed a little bit, because earthworms won't drown in water. They do take oxygen through their skin. But obviously, if you've got quite a thin burrow, the oxygen is depleted fairly quickly, so you don't want it being completely waterlogged.
Sure.
So yeah, we call those middens. So you can see those around, and yeah, absolutely. At night they will come up and then pull all these dead leaves just slowly down into their larder underneath. And then, munch away at that.
Working hard beneath our feet, aren't they?
Absolutely, yes.
So it's a little bit dry here. It's drier than where we were in a moment. Is this still good conditions to find earthworms in?
Yes, but ideally we'd find some nice sort of slightly more rotted logs than these.
Should we go and have a look over
logs
there?
Yes, let's have a look over there. Looks like there might be some larger. I think that one over there looks like a possible.
That does look
nice,
pretty impressive, spot. Actually. Isn't it?
Yeah, so I reckon this one might be good.
So how do the worms actually get the nutrients out of the soil when they're sort of digesting the food? Have they just got, I think you said they've got sort of a quite advanced gut bacteria.
Yeah, so they have a symbiotic kind of relationship with the bacteria in their gut, and that's kind of, it's them working together that then is making the soil much richer, and I think it's putting more nitrogen in and things like
so
that.
Put more nitrogen in, but they're obviously taking nutrients out for themselves as well.
Oh yes, of course. So that's coming from the organic matter. They're breaking that down and taking on board the nutrients from that, and then it's all coming out the
other end. Yeah.
Nice rich poo.
Delightful.
It's always good. Yeah, this one's quite heavy, although it's quite
what have we got here?
Let's have a look. What are you? Burrowing down.
There you go.
So what's this one?
So what are you looking at when you're trying to identify them? Can you sort of like talk about the biology of an earthworm? Because obviously to most people they're just a pink wiggly thing.
Aha! Right, so the first thing I'm looking for when I pick up an earthworm is I'm looking for whether it has a saddle or not. So the saddle is that fleshy band on the earthworm, and that shows that it's an adult, because I can't identify juvenile earthworms. So obviously, once we have all the barcodes, and you potentially could then identify the juvenile earthworms. But for now, we can't identify juveniles. So I just look for the saddle. Once it's got a saddle,
Then I always have a look to see what it is. But generally, to identify an earthworm accurately, you do have to preserve it.
Mm.
So obviously all juveniles will be let go. Also, if there's a few species I can sort of tell live.
In the field, yeah.
Yes, so ones that I'm certain of, I can then mark those down and release those, although we would need a few today for the sequencing.
Sure.
But yes, the others, then they will be taken up and we'll take those back to the museum and identify them.
Brilliant. And that, like you say, will add to our species list here, so we can learn a bit more about how quickly these earthworms are coming back to the landscape.
Yes, absolutely.
A really exciting thing. So another thing I wanted to ask about was actually the life cycle of the earthworm, which I find really fascinating.
So earthworms are hermaphrodites, and most of them will sexually reproduce. So they will find a mate. We found, like, fairly recently that Lumbricus terrestris, we know, actually is quite picky about their mate. So they will come out of the ground, find another worm, and then size themselves up.
Oh,
and
really?
Then, yes, they'll only mate with an earthworm that's as big as it.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's interesting. So do you know why that is? Or is that
maybe because of the pores lining up.
Oh,
I think probably.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
Rather than being picky about.
Yeah.
No,
it's actually got to be
another big worm.
Well, yeah.
No small worms.
What hobbies do you like? No, yes, you're not my type.
No, I'm not sure about you. Yes, but most earthworms, I think, are less picky. But yes, so they'll lie next to each other and line themselves up with the pores, and then they will release sperm. So then each worm will take in the other worm's sperm, which they store in special sacs kind of inside the body. They'll break apart,
mm-hmm.
and then when their own eggs are ready, those will then the clitellum, or the saddle, mm-hmm. will make a thick wad of mucus that okay. then starts to come off the head end, and then the stored sperm and their own egg get released into that, and then it comes off the end, hardens, and forms a little cocoon. So if you're looking through compost and you see those little bright yellow sort of balls almost,
yeah,
those are the
just been delivered.
Right,
oh
crikey.
My goodness, a big ball of worms has just arrived.
A lot of octolarians.
This one's definitely got a saddle. Just
yes, yes. These are some of the endogeic worms I mentioned. So you can see they've got this almost sort of purpley.
That is quite sort of a sort of purpley greyish sheen.
Yes, really
probably quite
nice.
A fashionable paint colour.
Yes, really nice worms.
Wow, that's very cool.
So I was saying about the cocoons.
Oh yes.
Yes, so then they go into the soil, and then they'll hatch out when conditions are right. Then they'll hatch out, and a little life baby worm will emerge. But some of the times of the year, some of the earthworms will be hibernating. So if it's too dry, they can either, depending on the species, go really deep into the soil, curl up into a ball, cover themselves in mucus, and stay safe.
I've seen that when I've been sort of digging in the garden before, like it's in our veggie patch, and it's like they kind of, is it estivate? Is that the right word?
Yes.
Or they kind of just
so in theory, in the winter
down.
They hibernate, and in the summer they estivate. But
so they like the spring and the autumn the best.
Yes, that's when you want to look for
damp,
earthworms. Absolutely.
And how long do worms live? Does anyone know?
It really does. And I think, again, it depends on the species. But also, obviously, earthworms are a huge food source. So they are being predated on all the time. People think the larger species could live longer, maybe sort of 10 years or so for terrestris. But then, not earthworms as such, but some of their like freshwater cousins. I met a guy at one of the conferences from Estonia, and he'd kept a really small little oligochete, almost as a pet, for like 47 years.
Just to see how long it would live?
Yeah.
47 years?
Yeah, and he had to do this massive trek on like trains across Estonia to get the right boggy sediment to kind of replace its soil once a year, or, you know, in its tank.
Like a little pilgrimage every year.
Yes. And then, yeah, wow, did that's, it 47 years.
That's amazing, so, though, isn't it? And when do they get to sexual maturity? Is it quite soon after?
Again, it depends on the species. So Lumbricus terrestris will take a lot longer than a composting sort of Icenia fetida or something like that. I think that can be really quick. They've got a really high turnover. Whereas I think Lumbricus terrestris, it's a lot longer, maybe even a year, I think, or something. Whereas I think it's just weeks for some species.
Wow, it's just so fascinating. The whole thing is this underworld, sort of underground world, isn't it? It's just all of this going on.
As Kieran was saying, there's just so much we don't know. So, yeah, we need to know a lot more.
And you're doing some good work to try and find it out. So I'm going to come back to you a bit later on, and I'm going to go over and speak to the other guys and see what they're up to.
Sure.
Thanks, and I'm going to leave you scrabbling around looking for worms.
Deal.
Thank you. Hello there. So I've just been talking to Emma about how we collect and sample earthworms and why we're doing it. And you guys are from the Darwin Tree of Life project at the Natural History Museum.
Yes.
Which is very exciting. Could you introduce yourself and say a bit about what we're doing here today, what you do in your jobs, because it's just fascinating.
Yes, so I'm the sampling coordinator for the Darwin Tree of Life project. My name's Ines Januszczak, and I'm basically in charge of monitoring all the samples that go through the museum. So either collected by museum curators or through external submitters as well. So we work with lots of different organisations across Britain, and they send us different samples which we then process at the museum.
Wow, that's a very cool job. Do you enjoy it?
I do enjoy it, yes. It's very crazy in that, you know, we're working with lots of different people and lots of different species and specimens. Mm. So I've definitely learnt a lot, and it's just exciting to see where all the work will take us.
Yeah, so you could say you're covering all taxonomic groups.
Yes, all of them. So if I'm based in the invertebrate department, and we actually are doing more work with chordates and just slowly branching out as the project gets bigger.
Great. And is a lot of your work in the field or in the lab?
It's a mix, actually. So although we do field work like we are right now, when we're processing all the specimens submitted to us, it's all lab based. So it's a mix, really.
So it just must be so fascinating every day.
Yes. Yeah. Every day is very different. Extremely different.
And have you had any oh my God finds where you're just like, it's so exciting that you've just, I don't know, found a new species to science or something like that?
I can't think of any off the top of my head, but it is true that every day we do get really exciting submissions, or mostly because the project really encourages people to look for species in areas where I don't think they're necessarily looking before. So I think we do get people who've been like, oh, you know, we thought this would be found here, but it wasn't, it was actually found somewhere else, etc. So I think it's really great that we're kind of pushing people to explore, you know, their areas and explore also their expertise as well. Yeah, so that's been really fun and interesting.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. Lovely to meet you. And I'll probably come back to you later on when we're sorting through things. And hello.
Hi, I'm Chris Fletcher. I'm research assistant for the Darwin Tree of Life project. I mainly specialise in marine invertebrates, so bit out of my depth in the woods, but luckily we've got a couple of earthworm experts.
You haven't had to put your wetsuit on today.
No. I'm always glad of a chance to put the wetsuit on, but not getting in that water.
So what's the actual process that you have to go to extract the data that you need from these species that we're collecting?
So first of all, the most important thing is that we get experts out in the field with us to identify all the species whilst they're alive, which is more difficult than for some species than for other, particularly because a lot of things are identified when they're not alive. So
so that's why it's important to have Emma and Kieran here today scrabbling around and going, oh, I found this, and you're going to take these back in sort of test tubes back to the Natural History
back
Museum.
Back to the museum live. And so for the Darwin Tree of Life project, we're trying to DNA sequence and whole genome sequence all eukaryotic species within Britain and Ireland. And we're trying to do that to the highest quality. So for that, we need flash frozen material. So with stuff like earthworms, we'll take them back to the museum, we'll anaesthetise them, and then we will cut some of its tail off and then flash freeze that. And that will go to the Sanger Institute for whole genome sequencing. And we'll keep a little bit for DNA barcoding, which we'll do ourselves back in the museum.
Oh, brilliant.
So it's all about getting that fresh, snap-frozen material for us, really.
And the rest of the specimen, because you're only taking a small part of it, the rest of the specimen will go with Emma and Kieran and actually be identified under a microscope back at the museum as well.
Yeah, probably identified, because they have some idea of what the species are when they just pick them up in their hand. Sometimes they can identify the species. Other times, you need a microscope and you need to look at its different features. So yeah, we'll preserve the rest of it in ethanol, which is important, so they can do further genetic analysis on it. Other chemicals can just destroy the genetic material, really. So yeah, we'll give that to them in ethanol, and they'll formally identify it, and then
that all links up with the whole record and everything you're doing back at the lab.
Eventually it'll get published as a whole genome, mate, which will be really exciting.
Very cool. And you're just about to go off on a really cool trip, aren't you?
Yes, I am about to go to the Porcupine Abyssal Plain, which is a deep sea area. It's slightly outside our boundary of Britain and Ireland, but it's just outside Irish waters, down where it goes really deep. So it's about 4,000 to almost 5,000 metres deep. I'll probably mainly collect crustaceans from there, but I've never been on a cruise like this, and I'm really excited because there's these species of animal crustacean called amphipods, and usually the ones we get around here on the coastline are around, you know, a centimetre big, but they're huge out in the deep sea. Not quite sure how big, but you know,
a lot
10
bigger.
Centimetres, 20 centimetres.
Yeah, super-sized crustaceans.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see those.
And you're going to be actually on the boat and sort of sorting through these specimens as they get brought up.
Sourcing through them and then taking tissue samples from them and then freezing parts of them, and then the rest of the specimen will go back to the NOC, National Oceanographic Centre, who are in charge of the trip, basically.
Brilliant.
And then hopefully eventually the specimens will stay with us at the museum.
Great. God, that sounds like a great... So how long are you going to be on the boat for?
About 3 weeks.
So it's really intensive kind of sampling and processing.
12-hour days, really hard work, working all the time, and then, off. No weekends either.
No weekends, oh no.
Yeah, there's a bit of relaxation time when you get out there.
Sure.
When you travel to the site, but apart from that, it's all hard work.
Yeah, but it's going to be fascinating.
Yeah,
probably
it's going
highlight
to be amazing.
Of your career so
definitely,
far, I should think.
Definitely, yeah.
Great. So nice to speak to you, Chris.
Yeah,
thanks
really
very
nice
much. Should we go and see what other worms they found over
let's
there? Let's have a look. So we're just digging around in the compost heap at the Regen Farm, which is full of rotting dung. And as the spade goes in, oh my gosh, it is full of earthworms. So guys, are we expecting to find new species that we haven't already seen today in this compost heap?
Yes. So in the compost, you get species that really like high organic matter. So we did have a look in some dung earlier, and actually we didn't find these sort of stripy composting worms that you might do, but here this is absolutely
it's teeming with it.
However, these stripy composting earthworms are not stripy at all, so it's sometimes people make an assumption that all composting earthworms are stripy, but we actually do have some species where it's a bit more variable than that. And actually it's only fairly recently that we've been able to separate them as different species, because all of their morphological features are the same. And I'm going to be really honest, with the ones that we've got here, I'm looking at them just with the naked eye, and I'm really not confident about what species this is. It could be one of two or three. So it is something that we're going to need to take away. We're going to get it sequenced, and we're going to look at it under the microscope and check its features to make sure we can be confident about what species.
Cool. It's a very sort of dark pinky kind of colour, isn't it? I don't know. Have we seen any others that colour today?
Yeah, so we've seen other ones that have this dark colour. We call them the epigeics. So they're epi means within, geic in the soil. So, epi means like outer, so like epidermis. Okay. So they live outside of the soil in the material that they consume. So that can be dung, it can be compost heaps, it can be really rotten deadwood, it can be thick layers of leaf litter. So any earthworms that you find there are quite often this dark red colour. The difference between the ones you get in the compost bin and some of the ones you get in the leaf litter, though, these are generally a little bit bigger. So a lot of the ones that you get in the leaf litter are quite small. If you think about it, it makes sense. If you're going to live out in the open as an earthworm in the leaf litter and not be protected in the soil, you're not going to be able to survive long if you're big. So most of them tend to be much smaller.
So that one's going to go back to the lab, and hopefully definitely. Get identified later on.
Yeah, definitely.
Under a microscope.
Yeah. Great. I mean, lab. It is possible that we've got more than one species here, even though they all look quite similar. Having had a look, I'm really not convinced that they are all the same.
So you might just take a few back in.
Yeah, definitely. Because it's actually the compost earthworms. Well, composting is obviously really popular. Compost earthworms, taxonomically, I think have been looked at a bit less. A lot of the research in the UK is on woodland, agriculture, things like that, where the money is. The species you get in compost, you don't find in the soil very often. So when people are digging soil pits and looking at agricultural land and woodland and the earthworm communities that they've got there, these quite often will get missed. So, yeah. Even really common composting species, we still have relatively few records for.
Well, it's good to see that they're all thriving here. Just putting a spade in, we can see, there's hundreds in there, isn't there?
They're going to be happy because there's lots of nutrients for them to feed on. It's the right temperature for them, so they're loving it here at Knepp.
So one thing I'm quite curious about is what would it look like, well, Knepp or anywhere, if we didn't have any earthworms? What would happen?
Well, that's quite an interesting theory. So that habitat does or did exist. So in America, in North America, the area of the Great Lakes, from the last ice age, earthworms hadn't recolonized that area. So what would happen is, because all of the decomposition services are provided by bacteria and fungi, it's much slower. And you end up with this layer that you call the duff layer. So it's a layer of leaflet that's much thicker than you would get in the UK or in the rainforest or other habitats where you've got earthworms. So it can be like 8 centimetres deep. So if you think about it, all of the animals and plants that you've got there, the fungi, they all have 8 centimetres of protection leaf litter before they're exposed to the rest of the world. Now, the earthworm species that we get in the UK, these are the species that are great for composting. They're used for fishing bait as well, and they're moved around in plant pots. So, the earthworm species that we have in the UK are now, a lot of them are invasive species in this Great Lakes area of North America. And they're actually causing a lot of problems because they get into this habitat and they just break down the leaf litter. And they're ecosystem engineers, so they literally change habitat from the ground up. There are arguments that they could make the habitat more susceptible to invasive plant species as well that have evolved alongside the earthworm.
So they're European earthworm species that
Have been introduced. Well, a lot of them are cosmopolitan. There. They're found wherever there are people. Because, unfortunately, people do tend to take a lot of things with them.
I suppose, are they coming in on root balls on plants and that kind
of thing? They might do, but I think the biggest problem in the States is that they're sold as fishing tackle. And what do you do at the end of your fishing session?
I just chuck them in the...
You dump your tackle, exactly. So they're still getting new infection points. So the United States are one of the few countries that actually have earthworm monitoring, like we have in the UK with the National Earthworm Recording Scheme that's hosted by the Earthworm Society of Britain. But the Great Lakes Worm Watch, as it's called, is monitoring earthworms for a very different reason. Some of the invasive species belong to Lumbricidae family, which is the European earthworms, which all of the native species we've got in the UK belong to. But they do have invasive species from other parts of the world as well. There's a genus that is known as the Asian jumping worms that are used in composting that are also causing problems out there. So, yeah, but they have a lot of the species that we have.
Sure.
Yeah.
And are the Asian jumping worms, do they jump?
Yeah, it's because a lot of composting worms will flip about a lot. So anybody who's got a compost bin will know that when they picked up the earthworms in their compost bin, they start flicking about all over the place. So these are earthworms that eat material with a lot of nutritional content in it, so they've got a lot of energy. I like to say they live fast, die young, so it's a really fast lifestyle, very energetic. It doesn't take long for a small population to become a big population. Sure. So they live fast, die young, and they have a lot of fun on the way.
Fantastic. Thanks, Kieran. So fascinating.
No worries. Right, this is drying out already. This one looked like a...
So we've had a fantastic day out in the field sampling earthworms with the crew here, and you're just about to head off. So thank you so much for coming along today. But as a final message, we want people to love earthworms, don't we? So what can people do, Emma, to love earthworms even more?
I know, and thank you very much for letting us come today. This has been amazing. And yeah, absolutely. If you want to learn more about earthworms and maybe come on some of our courses and learn how to identify them, then please do go to the Earthworm Society of Britain webpage and you'll get loads of information on there. We have blogs as well, also links to our Facebook page too. And yeah, and then look up what courses we have going on. If there's any near you, please do come along and yeah, get involved in your local community with earthworms.
And get your hands dirty, basically. Get down there and get going with the worms.
Exactly, exactly.
Great. Oh, thanks so much, guys. See you all again soon.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Many thanks go to Emma, Kieran, Chris and Inez for a fun day in the field and for sharing their incredible knowledge about the underground world of the earthworm. Thanks as always go to Matt Davidson for the wonderful music, Leah Brazier for the beautiful artwork and Ian Bunn for his masterful editing skills. I'm going to leave you now with some music from Richard Durrant's brilliant rewilding album from Side 2, which is Below Ground. And this song is called The Big Fat Earthworm, Lumbricus Terrestris. I can't think of a better song to leave you with. See you next time.